Hi, this is Pamela Laird, and you're listening to the Salonology Show.
So, everybody, a massive welcome to the Salonology Show. And today we are super excited to be welcoming the absolute business boss. That is Pamela Laird to the Salonology Show. Now, in case you don't know much about Pamela, let me give you the breakdown. Pamela is a die-hard industry boss. She grew up around her mum's salon and went on to be a nail queen, often being the go-to manicurist on set. And in 2017, Pamela went on to the Dragon's Den Island to pitch her beauty brand. And I have watched this. I watched it yesterday. And, oh, it looked terrifying. So she was there to promote her beauty brand, Moxie Loves, and received not one, not two, but three offers from the Dragons, which is practically unheard of. And she then went on to steal our hearts in The Apprentice, where she made it all the way to the terrifying interview day and held her own, even against the likes of Claude Littner and Linda Plant. And then she launched her brand, Moxie Loves, to provide amazing and effective beauty products that save time and slip seamlessly into your routine. She continues to dominate the industry with her unique mix of determination, knowledge, and badassery. So let's say a huge welcome to Pamela. Woohoo!
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. I know. I enjoyed writing that, actually. It was good. There was so much to write about and talk about. And first of all, I must admit, I'm a bit of a girl fan. Ryan and I love The Apprentice. And we're avid watchers of it, and we often find ourselves yelling at the TV because you get so many crazy characters on it, of course. But you always held your own, and we always thought, you know, this girl's a boss. She knows what she's doing. And you also have really lovely hair, which I always thought. She's got such nice hair, sort of thing that I notice, you know. So when Ryan got to speak on stage with you earlier this year, I was a little bit gel. So I'm super, super happy to have you on the show and really excited to share a little of your story with our Salonology tribe. So thank you, Pamela.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. And I'm excited to share. And I think not a lot of people know about my salon background. So yeah, it'll be fun to chat.
Well, I think that's probably a great place to start, really. So you did very much grow up in and around the industry, Pam. So what's your earliest memory of that? What did little Pam experience growing up that you know, embedded you into our industry?
I think I always remember going to my mum's salon after school. And I remember from quite a young age that she had some incredible brands. And I used to love just unboxing the deliveries when they'd come and fixing the display. I remember back that she had like Versace makeup and Borghese skincare, which like is so uncommon now. And I can't believe they're just massive brands. And yet that would kind of be where she started it with her skincare and makeup range that she had in the salon. And I just loved that. I loved the packaging. I loved playing with it. I loved getting my nails done, but I had terrible nails. So when I'd go in and get my nails done, the girl would be like, oh my God, you need to do something. And I just had the worst nails. I wasn't blessed with good nails at all. So they were kind of the first few memories I have of growing up around a salon.
And when did you know then that you kind of wanted to follow your mum's footsteps, or did you have no choice really? Was it kind of, you know, laid out for you in advance?
I think I probably did have a choice, but it felt like I was so drawn to it. I loved the glamour. I just loved, you know, the whole, it was like a family unit salon. You know, you go there and you could have something done. You could have a chat. You could play with products. And there was just something really social about it. And I really enjoyed that part. I think when I was in, we have like a transition year, like a gap year kind of in our, you know, you do a lot of work experience and things like that in school. And I think I realized then I wanted to train in beauty. So my mum brought me to the UK because there was nowhere in Ireland that would teach me at the age of 15. So did loads of one-to-one training on acrylic and gel. And the things that I was really drawn to were nails. And so mum kind of made it her mission to get me trained up as early as possible.
Love that. So were you sort of keen then to just kind of get through school as quickly as you can and get out there and like earn a crust, as it were? Or was school a happier time than that for you?
No, I hated school. Like I loved the social side, but I was the only one of my friends who knew what I wanted to do. And I think I just felt like it was such a waste of time. I was like, I already know what I'm doing. I'm already trained. I have two more years now. Why am I here? My mum was like, you have to stay in school. She would not let me leave. but like things were kind of moving on for her because she sort of drifted into distribution a bit. So Leighton Denny Nail Care, she took on distribution and training. So it started when I turned 17 that we would be traveling the country and launching it into salons and spas right around Ireland. And I was like, I just can't wait to finish school. Like, I want to be done. And like my teachers were organizing like mock exams. I was like, no, can't do that day. Sorry. Like, I have a meeting. I'm here, I'm there. And they would just laugh at me. But it was true. And then a huge opportunity came along to open a nail bar under the Leighton Denny brand within House of Fraser in Dublin. So that was a huge opportunity. So that I launched at the age of 18, like about 2 months after I left school, after I finished school, finished wow. my exams. Yeah.
That's incredible, really. Have you seen any of those teachers since?
They've invited me back, funny, to talk about, you know, my career to date, which I think is really funny because they definitely were like, it wasn't an encouraging place for doing your own thing. And I think I was like, well, you want me to come back and say what? That I hated it. I didn't say that. But yeah, no, I've come across a few of them.
And so you mentioned then obviously that was quite quickly out of that you were working for yourself and obviously sort of under your mum's banner as well. Have you ever worked for anyone apart from yourself?
So I'll tell you about a time. I was a couple of years into running the nail bar. We were growing the floor space, the footprint. It was looking like it was going to be a big success. And as soon as you kind of grow, you soon realize that with growth comes other issues, you know, staffing it, you know, you need more staff, more reliable staff, quality control, all of those things I found really difficult because I wanted to be there all of the time. And that's so difficult to do. I found it hard anyway. And we were let down a bit by staff. So I realized around that time, this to me doesn't feel scalable. Like I want 10 of these, but I don't think I could take 10 times the stress. And so I couldn't really figure out how I was going to grow it. And I thought, you know, this is a time where I need to just take a step back and do something else. So I was headhunted by another salon to open a nail bar within Dublin Airport and hire the staff, you know, get it set up and going. And so that was my experience working for somebody else. It was interesting.
Yeah. Would you do that again if the right offer came? Because I know, and the reason why I ask this is because me and Holly talk about this quite a bit. And Holly thinks that she's the world's worst employee, wouldn't want to work for someone else having, you know, yeah. done it her own way, as it were. So I'm always curious as to how other people feel about that.
You know what? I work really hard for other people. And I think that sometimes that you don't really feel the rewards from it in the same way. And you almost want to take control. So you're kind of like, yeah, you're telling me to do this, but actually, if we did it this way, it'd be better. And that's very hard. And I think I probably don't have the right attitude to work for someone else unless I was given complete free reign, which just never happens. So to answer, the long answer is no, I don't think that I would do it again.
Well, I want to jump in now. And I want to talk about this weird thing that we have in common, because Ryan thinks I'm really strange, that when I see pictures of little holes, it makes me feel weird.
Triphobia.
And you have this too, right?
Yes.
Oh. So it's real, because he doesn't think it's real.
No, it's real.
And my whole arm goes funny.
No, I swear. It's not like it's a fear as much as a strange feeling. And I first realized it when I watched American Horror Story. So don't watch that, because I didn't know I had it. I was just innocently watching it. And then all of a sudden it zoomed in on coral, you know, from underwater coral on a shelf. And I was like,
yeah,
I feel a certain type of way and I can't explain it. And then I looked it up and yeah, turns out there's a reason. Now, not that you see it in everyday life, but if there's like, now I know what's really popular in the UK, which I didn't realize until I was filming The Apprentice, is crumpets. And they are full of holes.
They really are.
We don't have those here, thank God.
Are they
not
a thing? Are they not a thing in Ireland?
No,
really?
No. And I'm very grateful.
Wow.
Very grateful.
Well, there's certain situations I've been in, and there was one with a sun-dried tomato, which really had lots of funny little holes in it, and it looked totally unnatural, and it scared me. And I put it on my Instagram, and I was getting people commenting, saying, oh my God, what is that? I obviously have this thing that you do. But Ryan doesn't think it exists.
Well,
so I'm pleased to find somebody that...
You're almost making out that I'm implying that Pam's a liar there, which I'm very much not doing. Although I do remember we did see one Holzer. We were out walking Maverick the Schnoodle, and you'd gone past. It was some sort of flower or something. Mm. And you were like, look at my arm. And all the hairs on your arm had all like stuck up, hadn't they? And you were like, but only on one arm.
Yes,
which was
only
weird.
Only on my right arm. It's right. Very weird. Very
anyway,
weird.
We digress.
Yes, we digress. Anyway, right. Imagine, Pam, you are walking down the street in Dublin. Yeah. Are you recognised?
No. Well, I mean, it's hard to know because in Ireland, people, like, we let Beyonce and Jay-Z walk down our main shopping street. They wandered the whole city. Nobody bothered them. No one spoke to them because we're real like, yeah, we know who she is, but we won't kind of let her know that we know who she is. You know, right. We're too cool.
I see. Too cool.
Too cool. Yeah.
So not really. I was actually, it just came up in my memories the other day around this time last year when I was out, I spotted in my memories on Instagram that someone came up to me while I was eating food, like a little girl. And she was like, oh, I saw you on The Apprentice. So that was probably one of the only times in Ireland. But anytime I'm in the UK, people hound me like, oh, well, at least they did kind of just after the show and during it. People were messing me going, I just saw you walk by a Travelodge. And I was like,
do you have to have big shades and a big hat on now and like a scarf around your head?
And yeah. I think some people do that thing where they're like, do I know her or do like, have I met her before or have I seen her somewhere? You know, there's that kind of thing too.
I think that really proves that Irish people are much cooler than English people, because if I saw Beyonce walking down the street, I think I'd probably cry and pass out. So we're definitely not quite as cool as you guys. You also have a dog.
I do.
And we are doggy people. Tell us about your pup.
I very smoothly there a few minutes ago texted my mum and said, get her out of the room. She's barking. I had to mute my camera. I was like, I love my dog. And her name's Tallulah. She's a Chihuahua and she's just over nearly a year and a half now. Oh, she's just adorable. I'm a huge dog person. I would love like 10 dogs and a huge dog, but my lifestyle pre the times we're in, I think, wouldn't have allowed me to have a big dog. So it's great. I can take her with me in the car and wherever I need to go.
Holly, what's your dream for the future, Holds, about re the dogs?
I want a dog farm. Yeah. So not to make them, not to breed them.
Not a puppy farm, crystal clear, no. We are not condoning that.
No. A place where all the dogs that don't have homes can come and live.
Rescue farm.
And they can all sleep on my bed. Yes, a rescue farm. Yeah, not a dog farm, a rescue farm. Where they can all come and live and just be free. And I can run around the garden with them all day. And that'd be like my dream. So Pamela, tell me, what does your average day look like?
You know, it's an interesting day because it's never the same. I think I describe my life to a lot of people like a million spinning plates. And so you're just really just trying to catch whichever one is about to fall. And so that changes every day. The side of my day I love is if I'm product developing. So if I'm working on packaging or concepts or samples are arriving, that's a fun day to me. So it could be none of that in one day. And I'm literally on an Excel sheet. Like yesterday I was working through an Excel sheet and trying to figure out a formula. That took up a lot of my day. And then today I sent off samples and I got some packaging samples back. So that was a fun day. But yeah, it's totally different every day, which is part of the fun.
Yeah.
Is it that creative side of it that you enjoy the most? Is that the bit that lights you up?
For sure. And I think I probably, if I were to like talk to myself a few years ago, everything was fine. I was able to manage. But now there's so much other stuff to be done that it definitely takes me away from the fun, creative side. So if that's the side you like, put someone in place quickly in the other side so that you can really focus on it, because that's probably the difficulty I'm having is balancing.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely a fan of doing that. And do the bits you enjoy and pass everything else off to someone else. Ideally, someone who's better than you at it, I guess, would be the ideal.
Right? Someone who doesn't struggle to do it.
No, absolutely. Pam, we like to do some quick fire questions as well, which we ask everyone the same ones. Are you up some quick fire questions?
I'm ready.
Excellent. That wasn't one of them. Okay. Facebook or Instagram?
Instagram.
New York or Las Vegas?
New York.
What do you have on your chip shop chips?
Salt and vinegar.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Yeah. Tea or coffee?
Neither. I don't drink tea or coffee. Monster.
Oh, Monster. Apple or Android?
Apple.
Excellent. Early bird or night owl?
Early birds.
What in our industry annoys you the most?
It's not a very beautiful beauty industry. I find it a bit ugly sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Amen. If you could cameo on any TV show, which one would you join?
Oh, that's hard. Handmaid's Tale, because I'm obsessed with it.
And last one, if you could get on a plane right now to anywhere in the world, where would you be going?
The Dominican Republic.
Nice. Bit of sun. Yeah. That's the end of the quick fire questions. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you. They were fun.
So we're going to talk about Dragon's Den, which was your first on-screen debut, like the cool factor, because you held your own so well in front of them. And they quizzed you, but they were really impressed by you as well, weren't they? Like, their communication back to you was, this is something quite amazing, what you created. You must have felt pretty proud.
Yes. You know what? What you don't see with the preparation that went into my Dragon's Den pitch is, once I got accepted onto the show, I thought, okay, I'm going to make it my mission. This is going to be, whatever happens, whether I get the investment or not, it's going to be like a TV ad for my product. So I tried to make it interesting for a viewer. And I also wanted to get across like the snippets of what I've achieved so far. And then the rest is sort of like, oh, I don't know what will happen. But I had decided to go to a communications clinic in Dublin. And I sort of went through my pitch. I didn't realize that he was going to film me. And part of the exercise was going to be watching it back. Because honestly, I don't think anyone needs a coach. Once you film yourself and watch it back, you don't need anyone to tell you what you've done wrong. You can instantly see it. And so he role played as a dragon, which totally took me off guard. And it was a disaster. So I went in all fun and this is my brand. And it was like, he just was like, blah, and I was like, oh my God, this is awful. And so he watched it back with me. He didn't even have to say anything. I was like, that was the worst thing I could have ever said, ever. And he said, look, you tried to give everything out. You left nothing for a question answer. He said, you can control what people will ask you. And that was the first time I'd ever realized the power in what you say versus what you don't say. So not saying it. He said, not saying, you know, we're turning over this. He's like, they're going to ask you. And then it sounds so much better because you're responding in a positive way. So I was taught how to, now just for that pitch, I haven't applied much of it to the rest of my life, but that is a great way to control how it's going to go by what you lead out. And I found that just a really amazing tool. And that's why my pitch went so well, I think. I mean, aside from, obviously, I didn't lie about anything, like I was upfront, but things that I didn't want to talk about, I had a way of leaving out, which I think is important.
That's really good advice, actually. I think I can probably take something away from that because I tend to overtalk. We both do. Oh. It's challenging sometimes between us because we both want to say everything. Now, of course, after you did the pitch, but then you had another investor come forward, didn't you, who you went with. But then there was a change in the regulations with single use.
There was.
So that must have been tough, like going through all of that, building that up, coming up with a pretty awesome product. And if those of you don't know what it is, it was called Eyecatcher. And it was a product that you could use as a consumer or as a makeup artist. So if any mascara, eyeliner went wrong, you could really easily fix it up without having to take all your makeup off, which is it's one of these like little hero products, isn't it? That can help you fix those little things. It's always been a niggle, but no one's ever come up with a solution. So you did that. And then, of course, all the regulations changed and probably took your legs straight out from underneath you. So how did you come back from that?
Oh, that was a really hard time. And I think that was the first time I realized that, you know, everything was at stake on one product. And that was my first mistake. Because I was building a brand and I definitely got too comfortable in sort of relying on the hero product and where we were going to go from there. And I think that that was a big lesson, to be ahead of the curve as much as possible. But also, what can I do now? I mean, I can fold the company. That's probably the easiest thing. But I believed that we were bigger than one product and I had so many creative ideas that I thought, okay, now is the time. So we took a bit of a hit as far as I had nothing launched. I had nothing to save us from this for about 6 months. But I brought out Barefaced. And if you haven't seen Barefaced, it's part of the Moxie Loves range. It's dry cotton wool that's infused with cleanser. So it's biodegradable, sustainable, but it's single use. So it still ticked the box of what Moxie Loves was, which was convenient, problem solving, all of the things that I wanted it to be. And I knew that the innovation, the creativity could get me through. And I knew that I had belief in the brand. So obviously determination and resilience. But look, I was devastated. You know, it's like the hero product is now the devil wrapped in plastic. Yeah. And I could never have foreseen consumer perception flipping. I knew sustainability was coming. I just didn't realize it was going to be like a carpet pulled from under me that fast. But that will just tell you the beauty industry, this is how fast it moves. And it was a lesson that I'm lucky I had early days that I could come back from and take valuable advice from what I didn't do the first time.
And I guess that might have changed how you created Barefaced, because that breaks down in 6 months, is that right?
That's
Whereas a wet wipe would be 100 years. So maybe had you not undergone that, you would have made Barefaced, which also with it then had to have been changed.
Yes.
So maybe in a way it was a wonderful thing.
It can be.
That helped you move forward in a different way.
Like the lessons, you know, obviously if I could go back and do it differently, I probably wouldn't, because they're lessons that you can't be told. Like you couldn't have told me at the time, listen, this is going to, you can't work on this. I'm like, yeah, but I have time. Like, you know, regulations are coming. They won't come in 2 weeks, you know, but they did. A photo circulated and it happened that fast. And that is how fast anything in business can happen. So huge lessons. Yeah. And you're right. It would have changed my whole product portfolio.
And what would you say was the biggest thing you took away from being a dragon before we talk more about Moxie?
From being on Dragon's Den?
Oh, being on Dragon's Den, yeah.
One step at a time.
Maybe.
Maybe they're watching, you know, who knows?
What did I take away? I think my foolish or my naivety at the time was, oh my God, three dragons. This is like amazing. Who wouldn't want three investors, three ideas, three business brains touching my brand and with their, you know, thoughts and ideas? And then I realized just really simply the logistics of having three business people who have multiple investments, trying to get them for one meeting, that was just impossible. The second thing was the reduction in the percentage of their shareholding reduced their interest and reduced, I suppose, the risk. So therefore, maybe just gave them less of a say. So therefore, they didn't really care as much, was the attitude that I felt by their lack of availability to meet me. And I saw what was ahead of me. So it taught me that cash isn't always the right move. Like you need to make sure it's coming from the right place and for the right reasons and the right partner. And so that to me was a huge lesson, because now I wouldn't just take cash because I need it. Whereas at that stage, I nearly did, you know, I needed it badly enough that I almost took the wrong deal.
Because they were going to all go in together, weren't they?
They were.
As opposed to three offers, they were like a combined offer of three dragons. So
Yes. That
would have been a lot of heads to manage and a lot of opinions coming into the pot as well.
Yes, for sure.
Right. So we're going to have to ask a few questions about The Apprentice, of course. The very first one is Karen as amazing as she seems? Because she's like the woman I want to meet. I am a massive, massive Karen fan. Do you have her number and would she go for lunch with me?
So I'll start with, what is she like? She's so glamorous, so stunning. And I love that about her, that she just shows up and looks really amazing. The other thing I'm impressed by her is that she's very, what's the word, like standoffish. And she does that really well, because I find that sometimes I naturally am quite like, hi, you know, and I don't really have that front that she so naturally has. And I'm a bit envious of that, because I think it's very valuable in business. I don't have her number and I doubt she'd go for lunch with me. She's not a very girl's girl.
Fair enough. I can probably understand that.
I think she'd go for lunch with Tom, actually, because she's definitely not a girl's girl like that, but she loved Tom's charm. So like, I just don't think I'm her person, maybe.
I just think she's just, like you say, so standoffish, but so well posed, isn't she?
Yeah.
She always delivers herself so well. So this is an interesting apprentice question that Ryan and I talk about all the time whenever we watch it. And I have my own theory on it. Why do you all wear a scarf when you leave?
Well, this is big inside secrets now, so get ready. So all of that has to be approved ahead of time. So basically you send off your dresses and then you separately have a coat and a scarf. And that is because the little exit when you got your suitcase is filmed during Easter. So I flew over an Easter weekend last year, long before I joined the house. Yeah, like a month before, 2 months before. And I filmed getting into a taxi, getting out of a taxi, walking. You know, it was a long day of strolling around. So we did the bridge walk. We did the You're Fired walk. And that was all done in one day.
Ah.
So that's because the girls have three outfit options, three dresses, and the boys have three shirts. And obviously, if girls are wearing suits, they have different tops. So that's to conceal whatever you were wearing that day. very simple.
So it's a continuity thing.
So that means then, so the winners would have also have recorded said, you know, taxi of, I don't want to call it a taxi of shame, but you know, the loser's taxi or however they dub it as well, right?
They did.
That's
and another
the magic of TV
thing is that actually both,
yeah, keep them coming.
Yeah, so both finalists, so Scarlett and Karina last year, would have both filmed, so they film alternate endings, so nobody knows who wins until the week that it airs. So Karina and Scarlett would have both filmed You're Hired and You're Fired, and then both filmed a victory walk. And yeah.
Oh, so that's got to be difficult to do your emotions, isn't it? Because they're telling you you've won, but actually you might not have won, and we'll tell you for real down the line, right?
And my mum always said, she was always curious why they were so lackluster about winning. Like, it was like, oh, yeah, you know, just very nonchalant. And that's why.
There's some amazing insider knowledge here. I like this. Had you won The Apprentice, how do you think that would have changed your path and where you are now?
Do you know, it would have made everything happen a lot faster. Although, considering, you know, not being living in the UK this year, I think it probably would have been slightly trickier. But I do think all the plans I have are far easier to do with a bit of cash in the bank. However, I think that I'm in a great opportunity now because I have a lot of people interested in investment who potentially are a better fit investor-wise and business partner-wise. So I don't know how further along I'd be, but I imagine a good bit further. But that's not to say it was the right long-term decision if I did take his investment.
No, absolutely. And how much of what the viewer sees is real? So like, how do 15 people go from asleep? And I know that you had a trick, didn't you?
I did.
Because you slept at the front of the house, right? So you would listen and you were a light sleeper. So you would wake up and you would wake up before anyone else did and before, because you'd hear the camera crew coming.
Exactly.
Right?
So basically it is TV. So at the same time, actually, I was literally pulling this out of a suitcase today. This is what I cheekily had set up beside my bed because we weren't allowed to turn the lights on. So I had a little baby ring light beside me. And I would hear the gate open. I slept at the front of the house and I'd hear the gate open and I'd be like, okay, the crew was coming in. So they'd maybe take 40 minutes to set up all the lights, all the cameras, because it was really dark before we would be woken and like, oh, la, la, wake up, wake up. So I had asked the girls, did anyone else want me to wake them? And they were like, no. So like nobody else woke up except me. And I went, the one time I answered the phone, they were like, you can never answer the phone again. You're clearly already ready. Like, you just know. So I was never allowed to answer it again. But I would get up a good 40 minutes before the wake up would happen. And then the issue about getting the 15 people downstairs. So we do have a very short time to get ready. So that was just why I used to get up early. But then what you don't see is everyone comes downstairs. And so the late people are always like the last, the dribs and drabs people to come down. And then they'll say, okay, so eat your breakfast off camera. But you're not allowed to go back upstairs and get more ready further. So you have to be ready. And then the cameramen come in, then the sound guys come in and they mic you up. So that takes another half an hour, 40 minutes. And then we film leaving 20 times because someone always forgets to close the door or the taxi door doesn't open or some fiasco. Or someone forgets to carry the like project manager file or something happens. So it's all back in again, do it again. And so the logistics of that take time. So that's why it looks like it's midnight or, you know, it's pitch black and then it's daylight. It's because by the time you get everyone down the stairs, time goes by.
And would you do it again?
Oh, 100%. Like, I wouldn't even think twice would I do it again. It was an amazing experience personally because I'm an only child. I've always lived with my parents by myself. And so to live in a house of 15 people, like the same, roughly around the same age as you, almost like siblings, was such a great experience and fun.
I think I read in an interview as well, you said that the vibe when you were in the house, it wasn't about what happened in the boardroom. It was about you guys just living together and going on this really cool journey together. And none of that, what the conversation that happened in the boardroom was never taken back to the house.
That's true. And for me, I think I never really took anything back. That's not to say that other people didn't. And of course, things, people just did not get on. And there's no way to sugarcoat that. I personally was always on a team with really sound people. I didn't have that issue. But then, you know, Nope, not everyone didn't get on 100% of the time, but you never really brought back what someone said about you in the boardroom. At least I didn't. Mm. Because, yeah, and also some stuff doesn't make it in. So you don't even know, like you're in a boardroom for 6 hours and like half of it, you know, isn't going to make it on screen anyway, you know? So it's kind of like, you're just like, look, whatever happens, happens.
Is it that the second Lord Sugar walks in the room, you're just the vibe changes and it's like a totally different environment?
Well, what you don't see is the day of the boardroom is extremely intense, and that's purposely to create an intense day and intense environment. So, you know, you can imagine we're all like, hey, like, you know, da-da, and then we go into the boardroom and like, how would that work? So I understand why they do it, but it's very traumatic as a person who's an entrepreneur, works for themselves and tells themselves what to do, to be told when you walk out the door of the house today, you are not allowed to speak to anybody. If you want to talk to a member of production, you have to put up your hand and leave the room and speak to them there. So it's to create or to remove the friendship vibe that you have, so that if you do need to say something, it's easier because you haven't just been hugging them and laughing. Mm-hmm. So by the time Lord Sugar speaks, you may not have spoken for 5 hours to anybody. You have a book and you're allowed to read it.
I would not cope with that. That would be impossible.
Like I can't do 5 minutes.
Like they bring out food and you're like looking at each other and you're like, someone says or looks somewhere and then you're giggling and it's like, stop talking, stop laughing, move over here. Don't look at her. Don't look at him. It's like being in school.
God, that's tough. Yeah. That's tough. So let's talk a little bit more about your lovely brand, Moxie Loves, which has just arrived in the UK. Which is super exciting.
I'm thrilled. To be honest, like aside from needing, you know, money doing The Apprentice, it was really also a platform into the UK, because although it's a neighbouring market for me, very close to Ireland, it's a completely different market. And to crack it, to break it, to launch in it is hard. And yet it's 10 times the Irish population. So naturally it was very enticing for me. And I'm so thrilled. So Moxie Loves now, we've 3 products and we're launching to Boots. We're also on Ocado, 2 really big accounts for me. I think I had Sainsbury's and Tesco on my radar. And then, you know, with people moving online so quickly, people ordering their groceries online like never before, I saw how many people were queuing on Ocado at one stage, you know, earlier this year. And so I thought, that's where I have to be. And it's a perfect place for us, actually. And I think it's just a great opportunity because people are moving and buying beauty, not just in their Boots stores or Superdrug, they are buying it in grocery. So I wanted to break that and I'm so grateful that I have. Also, we launched on Amazon because I think we all have increased our Amazon ordering. We're buying useless junk on there. Well, I am anyway.
Yep.
Daily.
Yep. Yeah. So, but my brand has, we have 3 products now, and kind of coincidentally and kind of on purpose, they're all dry products. We've no water content in any of the products currently out there. They're an anhydrous formula, so they're sustainable both from a packaging perspective, but also from, we don't waste natural resources during the manufacturing stage, which I think is a big USP and something we're going to see coming forward in trends. So dry products that you add water to before you use it creates a more potent formula too. So there's a lot of benefits in the style of products that we have currently. And yeah, I've kind of branched into hair care as well. I have dry shampoo sheets, which are little rice powder sheets that absorb all the extra oil from your hair. And I think that's just, you know, moving away from the aerosol, the traditional method of dry shampoo. So I'm always looking to make the packaging different, the application different, just trying to bring innovation and fun and affordability.
I'm going to let Ryan jump in with some questions in a sec. But one other thing about that, what I love about it is that you can take it on a plane. But it's so true, right? Because the liquid issues is a problem. And you now get that little limit of a plastic bag. And I love my products. And I've got 300 things for my body and all sorts of skins for my stuff for my face. I was in the salon industry for 10 years. And I'm always trying things. And, you know, you need this for this and this for this and this for this. And if you, particularly if you go away for a long weekend or you want to take some nice products on the plane with you if you're doing a long haul, it is nigh on impossible. Because you just can't fit everything in the bag. So agreed. I think it's genius because I can take it on holiday with me.
Thanks. And do you know what I used to hate? When you'd buy the minis of something to go away and you'd have to compromise because your favorite thing wouldn't be in a mini. And you'd be like, I'm buying this. My skin's going to hate me on Monday.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want that. I wanted it to be user-friendly no matter what or where you go.
Amazing. I love it.
So you're obviously an ideas person, Pam. That's obvious from these incredible ideas that you've had. But where do they come from? Is it a matter of, you know, identifying a need, or is it a problem that you've experienced and thought, oh my God, why has no one solved this? Or where's this all come from?
Well, to take it back to my first product, I think that was directly inspired by my time working on photo shoots and seeing makeup artists, you know, like all of us, make mistakes and see how they handle the mistake. And it's normally in a panic. It's normally in a rush, just like you and I, you know, when we make a mistake with our makeup at home. And so I was watching it and I was like, God, that's really silly way to do it. Is there no better way? You know, like, how can I come up with something? So sometimes it's literally just there and then. And sometimes it comes from, like, for instance, Barefaced, although there was a need for sustainability, there was also a need for me as a lazy skincare person, but with a mum who's a facialist who would never let me use face wipes ever, not because of sustainability reasons, but for my skin. I wanted to come up with something that I could use. Finally, all my friends were using face wipes and I couldn't. So I'm a lazy cleanser and I like to cleanse where I like to cleanse, not necessarily in the bathroom, but wherever I happen to be when I want my makeup off. So that was something that I looked at. And again, from having dry ingredients, you can have remove all of the parabens, preservatives, all of the things that make a wipe so harsh on your skin by making them dry. And so then my mum used, I mean, I never thought I'd see the day that mum would not be using a cleanser, but mum uses Barefaced every day, like every day. So I know I created the right product. So it's kind of a mix of experience in the industry, but then also things that I've been like, that's not really great. I'll remember that. And how can I make it better?
If someone's listening and they've got an idea like you had, or they've spotted again, where do you even start? Because it's not like, oh, I'm going to distribute someone else's product. This is, oh, I'm going to sit down and try and, you know, build, create something. I mean, what on earth are the steps that you took?
Yeah, I think that's a question I get asked a lot. And it was probably easier for me at the time to say that it was such an easy thing because I was working full time. I wasn't relying on it. So it was almost like my hobby, my evening thing, you know, okay. DHL yeah. man would arrive with samples and I was like, ooh. And it took so long, like so much longer than I thought it would. And to this day, I'm like, yeah, love that product. She will have that by whatever. And still it takes so much longer than I thought or than I think. It's the hardest place to start because I think you have to think about your ideas and what you're trying to achieve. Because someone shared my number with a brand creator and they were looking to make a bespoke skincare line recently. And I was chatting to her on the phone and she had such big ambitions and it reminded me of me at the beginning. And I said to her, look, you're better off getting something to market if you have an idea than trying to do six ideas and struggling because someone will come along and they'll do it quicker than you. So if I could go back and tell myself, it would be, okay, just think about this, get something out there. And so where do you start? Well, think of your idea. So for instance, I was looking for dry products. I couldn't get powder products manufactured anywhere in Ireland. They were all liquids. So I was like, right, I'm going to have to find someone who makes powder. So I was looking at mineral powder manufacturers, you know, literally Googling, trying to find it. And then through the years, obviously, I've been to Cosmoprof, which is incredible. You make such great manufacturing contacts there. And even now I have manufacturers like there that I'm like, okay, when I'm ready for that, they'll make that. And when I'm ready for this, I also went to Korea as well, which was really helpful. But obviously, if you can't go to Korea and you can't go to Cosmoprof, you can sign up to the likes of Cosmetics Business. I find that extremely helpful. I think they have another magazine that's an ingredient magazine like SB something. Sign up. It's about £300 a year, but it's so worth it. You get a directory of manufacturers. It's a touch point where you can see what other brands are doing. You can also see if manufacturers are launching a new way of making something or components. You know, there's literally like airless pumps. You know, they've come up with a one made from sugar cane, like that's all there. I click into that email once a week and I read what's happening. And so that's a great way to source a manufacturer. But I would say streamline your ideas. Don't try and be, you know, groundbreaking from, you know, day dot with all six products, let's say. Like try and expand your range. If I could tell myself, oh, how great, you've one product. Yeah, but look at yourself on the shelf. You have one product. Now I have three. I should have eight because that would be the whole shelf. So even if, you know, four of those products are not ones that I like, you know, blood, sweat and tears into, but they fill a gap in the market and my customer will enjoy it and will like it. But it's not something that I, you know, have like hand stirred myself. Sometimes that's a better route because you can always come back to it, make it better, replace it, but own the shelf, you know, get at least enough to have a shelf. Because if you don't, you might have two amazing products, but as a customer, you go in and all you see is two, but you see another brand has eight. Like your eye is drawn to the shelf that has a nicer color mixture. So that would be my advice to anyone starting out. Don't try and be so genuinely innovative from everything, because I just think unless you have an investor behind you, it's going to be really, really hard to do. Sorry, that was a rant.
No, it wasn't. It was brilliant.
Own
advice.
The shelf.
Own the shelf.
Own the shelf. Yeah. That's a hashtag right there.
Shelf. Mm. So where did the name come from? Is Moxie like a dog you had as a child or something? Where's the, or a person that's inspired you? Or where's the name come from?
So Moxie is nobody to me, but it's something that really meant something to me when I came across the word. So Moxie in the dictionary is M-O-X-I-E. So there's an E at the end of it. But for trademark reasons, we got to knock that off and add a loves in. That's a whole
Excellent.
Other story.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, Moxie means if you've got determination or drive, you're said to have a bit of Moxie. And it really came from a soda company in the US that was said to be so highly caffeinated, so full of sugar, that if you could finish it, you had Moxie. So it's a very much a girl boss word, I feel. You know, I felt like it, every kind of sentence that it was used in was very female orientated. So for me, it felt empowering. I liked that simply that if you wrote it down, it would look like my logo. You know, they were the kind of things that were important to me. Four letters. If it was in Germany, if it was in France and Spain, you could pronounce it.
Yeah.
A lot of other commercial things came into my mind with the name. And so for all of those reasons, that's why.
It's a great name. It's a real standout name as well, isn't it?
And if I can just interject with a story, I'm not sure if you remember, Ryan, but we were in Nashville last year and a girl served us in a bar and her name was Moxie.
It was like, yes, it was.
And she was really cool. And we asked her about her name. She said, it's not my real name, but I've changed it to Moxie because it means that I'm cool and fun and empowered and, you know, woman boss and all of this stuff.
We should send her
and
some
products. Called her name Moxie.
Yeah.
So,
I love that story. I wish I had met her. That would be a great story.
Well, she worked. She used to work in Dick's Last Resort.
Dick's Last Resort
and, like,
in Nashville.
The main, in, yeah. On Broadway
so
in
Nashville.
So if
you ever make it there.
So if you ever make it there, there, then...
I'll find
so,
her.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned that there are other things in the pipeline. You know, what does the next 5 years for Moxie look like? Where are you looking to take it?
Well, very much back to my advice that I give my earlier self is own the shelf. I want the shelf. I don't want to have two products. I want all of it. And I'm really inspired by some other brands. You know, actually, it was someone I had the pleasure of meeting. He was on The Apprentice, I think, 10 years ago. He's the founder of Carbon Theory, known for their charcoal soap. They own the shelf in Boots, and he and I launched at the same time. So I very much am inspired by his growth, his route to market. He's launched into Ulta. And so before I even met him, they were sort of the box ticks for me. You know, Priceline Australia, Ulta in America. There's a Shoppers Drug Mart in Canada. There, I more aspire to be on the shelves of the stores that I really look up to. And I think that I don't know where I'll be, but if I tick those boxes, I'd be extremely happy with myself. So I'm like, I want Tesco, I want Sainsbury's, I want Ulta. We're really just in the middle of chatting to Rossmann's, which are part of AS Watson. So they own Superdrug and they're one of the biggest retail groups in the world. So to sort of get on that would be incredible and just make my dream of being a global brand, because I think until you're global, I don't know if I feel successful until I make that happen. So hopefully within 5 years, I'll do that.
I don't doubt that for one second. Tell me, if you could have, I love this question. It's not mine. It's Holly's. I'm not going to steal the credit for this, but if you could have a paparazzi snap any celebrity in the world with your, or using your products, who would that be? Who is the, who's the ultimate poster girl for Moxie, if you like?
You know, there were two actually, I think. And I mean, it has to be Kylie Jenner for her marketability. Mm-hmm. If I had Kylie Jenner with my product in her hand, every news article would pick it up. You know, Boots would repost it and they wouldn't charge me thousands to have an Instagram post on it. And that, you know, that would get me on the Daily Mail. So that would be a huge, like, ticked box. But closer to home, you know, I really feel like Mrs. Hinch is incredible. I love Stacey Solomon. Although they're probably not the biggest celebrities, I would love for them to use my products because I think they're busy mums. You know, they look
after
their
skin. They're so relatable, aren't they, as celebrities?
Yeah, they are. And I feel like they would be amazing ambassadors for my brand. So one day, maybe. Actually, I did Stacey Solomon's nails about 10 years ago, which is kind of funny.
Have you shipped her a box of your products? Because it can't be that difficult to get that into her management's hands, could it?
You'd be surprised.
Oh, really?
Very difficult. I think Stacey is signed up with another brand for the foreseeable.
Oh, I see. Got you. Okay, so you've said a little bit about where you want Moxie to go, but what about for you personally, Pam? Where are you looking to take Pamela Laird, the brand, in the next 5 years? Because do you want to do other stuff in addition to what you're doing with Moxie? And, you know, where do you want to be in 5 or 10 years? Because I get a feeling that's, you know, you're still going to be around doing lots of big things.
I think I will. And I've huge ambition. It was funny. I met somebody the other day and we were just talking about something. And she said, "Would you not do?" And I said, "Oh, no, I have about 5 brands I want to do right off the top of my head that are amazing product ranges, just not right for maybe the Moxie brand." So I would love to be able to begin working on some of my other ideas. And that's why I'm really looking for an investor to be able to scale up the business, to allow me to develop my creativity more. Because that's definitely where I'm happiest. And I feel like I have a lot to give the industry with products and ranges and brands that I would love in 5 years to be comfortably able to work on multiple brands and not spinning plates. You know, be able to know that the tax return is being done and someone paid the VAT, or, you know, the little things that obviously keep me up at night. And I would love for that to be placed with the right people and me be able to do what I love. But obviously, I know my business and personal is so interlinked, and you probably, anyone who works for themselves, you know, it's like, oh, do you have enough me time? To be honest, if my business is doing well, I'm happy, like I'm personally happy, and then it allows me to enjoy other things. Whereas I won't rest until I get to a place where that's the case. And so personally, I think to be able to just go to sleep and not worry would be lovely. You know, worry about something I've missed. So if 5 years till that comes, I'll be delighted.
I think that anyone who has their own business can completely relate to the how interchangeable personal and business, you know, the lines are so blurred, aren't they, between what we do. So how else can people learn more about Moxie then, Pam? This is your chance for a big plug. Obviously, plus an investor. If there's an investor sat around somewhere that's listening with a big sack of, well, I suppose they'd be euro bills as opposed to pound notes, wouldn't
they? I'd take anything, right? Sterling, dollars.
MasterCard.
But to be honest, I'm probably going to find my investors in the UK anyway. I don't think it'll be in Ireland. So
sure.
Yeah, I'll be ready for my pitch. So I guess you can find me on moxieloves.com. You'll find all the links to me. I've had people reach out on Instagram, so investors reach out on Instagram, mainly LinkedIn. I can weed through everyone selling me stuff to find a good investor in there. But again, it's Pamela Laird everywhere and moxieloves.com. And yeah, find my products on Boots. That would be the best place to support me, or Ocado, because that's where I want to succeed.
And they get some advantage points as well, presumably, if they get them all from Boots, right? So go big on the Boots. What a perfect stocking filler, because it's probably almost time to talk about sorts of things. Well, we'll put all of your links to everything, Pam, of course, on the show notes. And really, we would again just like to say thank you ever so much for being our first ever guest.
Yes.
So there we go. I don't know, maybe we can get you a rosette or something for that, because that's terribly exciting. But we would like to thank you for your time.
Very privileged.
Yes, well, no one else has got one. So it is literally a world exclusive.
Yeah, we've enjoyed having you on immensely. It's been awesome to talk to you. And, you know, our audience is salon owners and girls who are out there working hard against the grain and pushing themselves forward, and people who want to get somewhere. And it's having people like you on podcasts like this that help them to think, I can do it, and the opportunities are there, and I've got to work hard and put my hand up and own the shelf. So,
own the shelf.
Own the shelf.
Pam, thank you ever so much.
Brilliant to have
you. See you soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye.